Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy, and I am here as usual with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. Today, we're going to be talking about the report put out by the President's Working Group, which includes Janet Yellen. So I think it's fair to say this is kind of a Treasury report on stablecoins. And there's a lot of concerns buried within these 26 pages. Do you want to outline what your takeaways were from this or the major points of it?
Sure. It seems the federal government is going to want most stablecoin issuers to become OCC chartered and FDIC insured banks, effectively. So they will no longer be allowing trust companies, it seems, like Paxos to continue just existing as trust companies. And other ones like USDC and Tether would have to find a way to get bank charters. And not just any bank charters, because, for example, Paxos already has conditional approval, but as an uninsured trust company, which would not match up with the standards that the federal government seems to want. There's a couple of other important details I think we should bring out before we really get into it. One, they recommend that Congress passes legislation outlining these new requirements. There's a couple of bills in Congress right now that this would apply to, that this could potentially apply to. Episode 16, we had Rohan Gray on, one of the people behind the Stable Act, to discuss some of the importance there and why treating these money transmitters, these stable coins, more as banks helps promote stability and security. And so this would seem to be a very positive development for that bill. The other one is the Digital Asset and Market Structure Investor Protection Act or something, which was the surprise one that was revealed in a House committee a couple months ago that rumors are basically came directly from the Treasury. So considering Yellen's involvement in this report and that bill supposedly coming basically directly down from the Treasury, my guess is they are leaning towards that type of structure. The other last detail is they make very clear that if Congress does not pass legislation, and even potentially if Congress does, the SEC and the CFTC still definitively have jurisdiction over any stablecoin that is being used for commodities trading or any stablecoin issuer that's purchasing securities to back the stablecoin. And so regardless of whether or not Congress acts, it seems that the federal government, and especially the SEC and the CFTC, are going to be more proactive than they have been in regulating stablecoins.
A lot of people are talking about how stablecoins as a whole represent very little, not even just in terms of overall cryptocurrency market cap, but in terms of like the U.S. financial system. I mean, they are not a risk to the U.S. financial system. And I do think that as of right now, that's quite a fair assessment, right? Like Tether collapse ain't going to cause the S&P 500 to dump. It just is not going to happen. But I don't think it's unreasonable to start creating these suggestions and these working groups, because the reality is this has been moving really fast already. And they haven't done anything. People have been dying for clarity. People want to get the U.S. government to say something about it. And now that they have, I feel like the pushback has been, why are you guys harping on stablecoins? They're not that big a deal. And I'm wondering what your personal feeling is to that assessment.
I think they're right in a sense. Right now, stablecoins are primarily used as casino chips at the casino, right? But I think from the perspective of the federal government, seeing this growth of basically this shadow banking sector has to make them somewhat nervous, right? We've seen Tether over the last year grow several fold, USDC grow at an even faster rate. And assuming they continue those rates of growth, they become these very major problems quickly. And yeah, so I still don't think they represent a threat to the global financial system or anything like that, but there are increasingly some strange dynamics. If we assume these stablecoins represent like this major source of liquidity to crypto, and it drying up would be bad for crypto, especially due to the amount of leverage in it, and even the amount of embedded leverage in things like Tether's lending agreement with Celsius, it becomes increasingly probable that a problem with a stablecoin could cause significant issues across the crypto industry. significantly larger than the market cap of these coins. The more crypto becomes integrated and accepted into a broader economy, the larger the potential shockwaves of that becomes. The other problem I think they're trying to get in front of is we increasingly see stablecoin issuers trying to position themselves as tools for payments or remittances for a broader population outside of this outside of this much smaller group of crypto investors and speculators. And we see this with like Paxos and USDC partnering with these major payment providers like Visa and MasterCard and things like that. The more broadly used these are and are expected to be at a dollar, the more regulations there needs to be on it, because failure to maintain that represents a much larger issue. This is also part of the problem historically with things like money market funds, right? Is they act so much like cash until they don't. And when they don't, because they're this source of liquidity and this trusted thing that looks like a dollar, it causes these knock-on consequences as that liquidity dries up.
And at some point, regulators have to get involved with all of this. I mean, it's an inevitability. If these things intend to continue to exist at all, you would expect regulators to come in to regulate them. So I'm not exactly sure why anyone is surprised that the Treasury is interested in U.S. dollar derivatives and is perhaps concerned about U.S. dollar derivatives. I would suggest that it's almost bullish in comparison to what we saw with the reaction to like Liberty Reserve, where the reaction to Liberty Reserve was not to do a working group and examine it thoughtfully and try to figure out a way to create a regulated market for it. It was to shut that down. They aren't suggesting that actually in this. And I think that that could be perceived as bullish for the space in general.
Yeah, though I do think it's probably pretty bad news for Paxos, Tether, and USDC, mainly because it is very challenging, as I understand it, to get an OCC charter and then also to qualify for FDIC insurance, right? And there's a whole bunch of existing entities like JP Morgan and all these other places that already meet those characteristics. And so there's going to be potentially a window and opportunity in which Paxos, USDC, and especially Tether may not be able to compete with more traditional financial entrants into this space.
But I do want to say that that is still a much different tone and take than what we saw with Liberty Reserve, where these people are still in prison, or one of them is still in prison and one of them was released shortly after he was in prison. My point being that these people won't necessarily have to worry about that kind of consequence, even if they have to unwind the business and move on, because they've been profitable. Many of them have done very sketchy accounting practices and kind of business practices in general. And if they can get away with that without going to prison or having their money taken from them, I would clock that as a W. But I don't know what that means for them. I think for them, if the business fails, they feel like they're a failure.
Yeah. And I think also that Tether may occupy a unique space different from USDC and Paxos, just based on the existing information we have from enforcement and stuff.
And beyond that, this is part of what my main point was going to be on this discussion, which is you can look through this whole document from the president's working group. And it's very interesting. And there's a lot of explanations of what stablecoins are, how they operate. I mean, these are things that people who are in the ecosystem in general already understand, because you have to, because they're being discussed constantly. But more interestingly for me was the footnotes. And that seems to always be the case with whether it's court documents, the president's working group, whatever. When you start getting into the footnotes of this, you start getting into some really crazy stuff. And stuff I'm learning for the first time, which is, for instance, the pass-through deposit insurance coverage. I don't know if you read that little bit, but they talk about how oftentimes accounts that are, you know, a fund are not insured for each individual up to $250,000, but rather the fund itself is just insured FDIC for $250,000. And so all the people who are within this fund, if this fund goes under or something happens, like the insurance is $250,000. It is not $250,000 for every single person. And I was not aware of that. That is fascinating to me. Additionally, some of these footnotes seem to be explicitly referring to Tether. Like, they talk about how most holders of the coin in some of these cases aren't able to get a redemption because redemption is only $100,000, for instance, or more. And most of the people who hold the coin don't have that much. Who could that possibly be referring to, I wonder? And, like, the fact that they're implicitly referring to Tether over and over and over again leads me to believe that as much as Tether wants to play this whole, like, we're so happy to hear from the president's working group and we're looking forward to meeting these requirements, they are fucked.
Yeah, the Tether casts a large shadow over this document. And like you're saying, you see it in so many of the comments in here. Stablecoin redemption rights can vary considerably, not the pass-through insurance, the potential for fraud. They discuss how a certain laxness in accounting standards or in record keeping could cause there to be a mismatch between the reserves and the number of issued tokens. There, a lot of the behavior they describe as like the potential risks of stablecoins, they're just directly listing things Tether has done.
That part to me, while I'm bullish on this response compared to, again, say, Liberty Reserve or some other quite obviously criminal entity, it doesn't sound good for Tether to me because it sounds like the Treasury has a really keen interest in Tether. And we know the SEC is interested in them. We know the CFTC has been interested in them. We know the New York AG is still interested in them. And we know that the DOJ is interested in them. So it becomes this weird, like, you guys can pretend to be bullish, but I don't know how this document could possibly be perceived as bullish for Tether. I guess I'd be interested to hear how they could kind of finagle it that way.
I would love to hear Vandervelde discuss exactly how he feels that this is going to impact Tether. And I welcome Vandervelde at any time to come on this podcast to discuss that kind of thing with us. And even like in Tether's statement, this was one of the tersest and shortest statements I've ever seen Tether issue in response to something.
I'm 100% sure it was a troll. It was a response to Hindenburg Research saying, now you're supposed to say, we welcome this. And so what did they do? They immediately
said, we welcome this.
And they think it's funny. It is funny. You're just making fun of people who are criticizing you. I mean, it's funny until you're, you know, under investigation for bank fraud or wire fraud, until the Treasury is calling you out by name, until the SEC says we can't respond to your FOIL request because we're investigating that entity. When those things start happening, the Tether leadership can feel free to laugh it off if they want to. I hope they do.
Yeah. This report to me seemed bad for Tether, just flat out bad. I can't imagine Tether with their history, with their settlements, with all the malbehavior, with what their reserves are invested in, ever being able to get an OCC charter.
I'm looking through this, and again, I just want to reemphasize this. It to me is bullish for cryptocurrency and indeed stablecoins also. The idea is they are accepting almost that this new industry is going to exist as long as they can see. And they're looking to try to regulate it and figure out some way to understand it. And that's a really good thing to think. Like that means your industry is a force and the government cares more than they ever have before. Again, though, it does not seem good for Tether. It does not seem good for Tether because everything they're worried about are the things that Tether has done to lie and deceive and trick the general public at large, not once or twice or three times or four times, like over and over and over and over and over and over again. This is not like a one-time off thing, but it's nice to see the Treasury of the U.S. government being like, yeah, we're aware of all the f***ed up shit that Tether is doing. We see it. We're concerned. They should be concerned.
Yeah, they should have probably been concerned a little bit earlier than they were, but, you know, better late than never. Honestly, some of the new information we've gotten about Tether in the last several months, to me, really makes something like this seem inevitable. Like, early on in Tether's history, at least the story is that Tether was fully backed by cash. And a trust company holding a bunch of assets in trust to back a token is one thing. But for a lot of its history, Tether has been engaged in basically outright shadow banking, doing lending, creating deposits, doing all these things that are so very bank-like that it really seems inevitable that someday someone was going to say, it really seems like you're a bank. Why are you not a bank? Why do you get to do these things that only banks can do? And there's a whole bunch of people in the cryptocurrency ecosystem right now worried about the fact that stablecoin issuers are going to have to become banks, basically, because becoming a bank is not easy, and the regulatory load on banks is much higher than it is for these kind of trust companies.
Isn't this when you would go and buy a bank charter, like from an existing bank?
Maybe. I don't know. You'd think so.
I mean, I would suspect that if these guys have as much money on the books as they claim they do, they could buy some, you know, at least medium-sized community banks and get the charter they need to do most, if not all, of what they're desiring to do. But I think a lot of them aren't operating even the way a bank would, really. I think they're operating the way a hedge fund would.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of what might be frustrating Paxos and Circle, is that they do not seem to be engaged in the same kind of lending practices, the same kind of securities investment, the same kind of things that Tether has so brazenly done. I should caveat that with saying there was a period where Circle was invested in a whole bunch of securities, but we've not seen reporting suggesting that they're doing like what Tether is and creating tethers in response to like these secured lending agreements, or especially not doing the type of unsecured lending and stuff we've seen Tether doing. And so it seems that Tether casts a shadow over this report, that Tether might be one of the main animating forces behind these governmental agencies being worried about this. And so now everyone gets to be a bank, like they probably always should have. And so if you're over at Paxos or Circle or Center, I can see you being frustrated because you perhaps hoped to have a few more years before you had to be that. And I think that, like, they knew they were going to at some point have to become a bank. And that's why Paxos already went through the process to get a conditional OCC charter as a trust company, and why Circle is trying to get a bank charter. And I discussed this when I was writing about this, is I think they knew it was inevitable with the things that they wanted to do, that the federal government would at some point say, that sounds like a bank.
Here's something I wanted to touch on, which is Terra USD. And the Terra company, Do Kwon and some others, seem to have been served by the SEC recently for what they're doing. Do Kwon then went on Laura Shin and said that there is no chance that the SEC can stop Terra and that he can't really be prosecuted for this and is countersuing. I want to clarify, neither of us are lawyers before we say a word about this. But for me, it was actually very interesting to see that. Like, not only would I think you don't want to say those things, is countersuing just like a move to be like, come on, let's just settle? Quite bold. And if it pays off, it'll be quite a signal to the community. And so I am actually interested.
Didn't Telegram countersue the SEC too? Isn't that what the Defend Crypto Fund was for? Well, I think specifically in this case, the claim by Do Kwon was that the service was improper, that the way they served him the documents was not appropriate, and as such, he had not yet been served. And so basically, the case could not proceed because he hadn't been served pursuant to the appropriate regulations. It was the first claim he was making.
Is that accurate?
I don't feel qualified to answer that. My intuition is that the SEC and the whichever judges would end up on this case would probably not be convinced by that, but I haven't looked at the specific details or the specific laws, so I don't want to go too far in my opining there. The other part, that Terra can't be stopped, I hope that's true, right? I mean, the entire point of these partially collateralized and all these like DeFi stablecoins is that the entire reason for them to exist is that they should be unstoppable, right? There should be no way for the SEC or anyone else to arrest or serve anyone and stop these tokens from circulating.
It's really bold, I think. And fair enough, I'm not suggesting no one should do it. But I think it's really bold to create something that can't, you're like, this cannot be broken. Like, this is shatterproof. And like, once I release it into the wild, it will go on its own and it will be fine. And I think that's almost always wrong. And you can just look at like most examples of people saying something is unsinkable or not breakable or a totally safe investment and see how false that is. Now, I also understand that when people say to a degree that like DAO is the stablecoin, sorry, the stablecoin DAO is only within the cryptocurrency ecosystem and therefore like it's less of a risk in general, but also it's mostly collateralized with USDC, which is exposed to the general ecosystem of finance and therefore helps expose, like it does create exposure to the general system, I believe. And so it's hard for me to imagine any of these are unbreakable.
My general opinion that I've expressed previously on a podcast and stuff is that algorithmic stablecoins are basically never unbreakable. They're a pegged currency. They're often going to suffer under an attack by a sufficiently well-capitalized attacker. Certain over-collateralized ones and even partially collateralized ones like Frax expose themselves to basically U.S. government intervention by, like you mentioned, using USDC, which can be frozen whatever and become effectively worthless. However, my favorite things in cryptocurrency are the contracts that cannot be stopped, right? Now, this isn't to say that they'll never be flawed or anything, but often I think the best parts of cryptocurrency are the really censorship-resistant, resilient ones, and those are often dependent on there being very little intervention you can do after it's been deployed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They're constantly intervening in Bitcoin and Ethereum. You have teams of developers working on it all the time. So this idea that you're ever giving up, like you're giving up control as an individual, but there's constantly people working on it to try to like make it better. And fair enough, like DAO has that, right? Like Terra has that. They have teams of people who are working on their products. But like you said, there's always an attacking force that could look. George Soros is the classic example of someone attacking a currency and winning just through having the amount necessary, the liquidity necessary to destroy it. And all of these things suffer from that same exact issue, which is if anyone like George Soros decided, fuck it, I'll throw $1 billion in to destroy this thing, they could probably do it. I just think no billionaire has that interest right now.
And often there's no direct incentive for it, though. And we discussed this with Francis, like in the example of a partially collateralized one like Frax, often there is an incentive, right? Because if you can attack the peg long enough to drive the value of the supposedly stable token underneath the amount of collateral backing it, you can basically redeem it for the collateral and make profit that way. And so there are potentially profitable attacks on some of these systems. They just require a sufficient amount of capital to basically sustain the attack. I think Doquan is probably being overly optimistic about the resiliency of Terra, but as like one of the creators of it, he kind of has to. Because the worst thing you can do to an algorithmic stablecoin or a partially collateralized stablecoin is to express doubt in its continued functioning, because that doubt will cause it to cease functioning, right? These are perpetual motion machines. If you look at them too hard, they'll stop moving. And so you need to make sure they keep moving.
On that, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next week.